I'd like to say thank you, express appreciation to the organizers of Torah in Motion for including me in this afternoon's program, giving me a chance to take part, and also to my good friend, the Mara D'Asra, Rabbi Chaim Strauchler of Shari Shemayim, for hosting us today. The Yalkut Shemoni is a collection of Midrashim. In the Yalkut's explanation of Yirmiyahu, discussing the destruction of the Temple of Yerushalayim on Tisha B'Av, we find a very picturesque expression as follows. The Aryeh, the lion, the Aryeh ascended in the mazel of Aryeh and destroyed Ariel. The lion ascended, the Aryeh, this is Nebuchadnezzar, as we find written in Yirmiyahu and Jeremiah, a similar reference, a lion is ascended from his thicket. Furthermore, in the mazel of the lion, again Yirmiyahu, first perek, the carrying away of Yerushalayim as a captive in the fifth month. That's the month of Av, which we presently find ourselves in, counting from Nisan as the biblically reckoned first month. For all you Leos out there, you know this is your mazel. And the idea of destroyed Ariel references Yeshayahu, Isaiah. Ariel, Yerushalayim, the city where King David, where David HaMelech encamped. And until Ariel came in the mazel of Ari and will build Ariel, this is the arrival of Ariel is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it says in the prophet Amos. The lion has roared, who will not fear? The Lord God has spoken, who can but prophesy? And finally, B'mazal Ariel, again Yirmiyahu, I will turn their mourning into joy and will comfort them and make them rejoice from their sorrow. In the words of Tehillim, of Psalms, God builds up Yerushalayim and gathers together the diaspora of Yisrael. All these expressions in Torah, in their precision, express particular meaning above and beyond their poetic splendor. Let's look deeper and try to understand how the expression of the lion, the Aryeh, is used both with respect to the destruction as well as to the reconstruction and restoration of the Beis HaMikdash, of the Temple in Yerushalayim. Keep in mind the question of how it is possible to say both Nebuchadnezzar's conquest comes in the fifth month, etc., and also HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, will come and build the Beis HaMikdash in that time, and what we can possibly infer from the fact that they are both referred to as the lion. In brief, we'll find a perspective on this midrash in halacha itself, although this should not be shocking, as it's really all one Torah. The halacha, as formulated by Maimonides, states, one who shatters vessels, or tears clothing, or destroys a house, or anything of that nature, in a way of destruction, violates the prohibition of bal tashchis, wanton destruction. However, the Rambam continues in that place, it's in Hilchos Malachim, to explain that such a person is only liable to the rabbinic punishment of lashes, Malchus Mardus. When we talk about the temple in Yerushalayim, moreover, not only can we ask a question from the halacha of Bal Tashchis, the prohibition of wanton destruction, we should also wonder whether the prohibition of destroying even a component of the temple has force in this case. Again, Maimonides, this time in the Hilchos Beis HaBechira, the laws of the temple, one who removes one stone from the Mizbeach, or from the Heichal of the temple, or from between the Ulam and the Mizbeach, in a way of destruction, is punished by lashes. As the verse says in Deuteronomy, Parshas Re'eh, and you shall break down their altars, in other words, those of idolaters, but you shall not do that, you shall not do this, to the altar of God your God. If there's a prohibition in halacha of removing one stone, how much greater must the prohibition be of destroying the entire temple itself? Rambam lists in his counting of the 613 mitzvahs, lav number 65, prohibition number 65. You should not destroy the Beis HaMikdash, or synagogues, or houses of study. It seems like a clear prohibition. Given these instructions, these mitzvahs, prohibiting destruction, we might thus be moved to ask, what was God doing on Tisha B'Av? What was he thinking, Kvayachal, so to speak, in allowing the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, to be destroyed? In God's own Torah, it teaches us not to destroy, and then God allows it to happen? What's the root of this question? What's the basis of this wonderment? We operate under the principle that God also keeps the mitzvahs, in a sense. As we know from the verse at the end, towards the end of Psalms, Magid Devarav li Yaakov, Chukav u'mishpatav li Yisrael. He declares his word to Yaakov, his statutes and ordinances to Yisrael. It's God's mitzvah also. Then we are able to hold God accountable, so to say, for this destruction. Is that possible? How could he let this happen? You'd say it even stronger. The destruction of the temple, the sacking of Yerushalayim, and the Jewish blood that was spilled seems, at least from one point of view, to have occurred by the hands of agents sent by God. They were on shlichut. As we read in Yirmiyahu again, God says, I will send Nebuchadrezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and bring them against this land and against the inhabitants of it. I will utterly destroy them and make them a permanent desolation. If the reason that the temple has to be taken away from us for a certain amount of time, whatever that is, if this is because the Jewish people aren't behaving in a manner that makes us deserving of a Beis HaMikdash, of a temple, so let God conceal it. Let him put it in Geniza. There's a Gemara like that in Sota, that the Mishkan was concealed. Why destruction? Why such an extreme step? Why is that necessary? Let's first look a little bit deeper at the prohibition of Baal Tashchis. The operative concept here, as we mentioned before, is the idea of wanton destruction. In other words, destruction that doesn't serves no positive purpose. Last night, maybe even today, we read in Eicha, God has fulfilled his fury, it says in the fourth chapter, on which Midrash Rabbah remarks, pour out your anger on the wood and the stones, meaning those of the temple, and do not pour it onto Yisrael. In this sense, we're not confronted with a problem or prohibition of Baal Tashchis, because the destruction is not purposeless at all. Rather, it has a purpose. It's a deflected anger. Recall that the prohibition, Baal Tashchis, waste, ruining, only applies when the destruction is in a way of wastefulness. But here, where it has a purpose, seemingly at some level the destruction, as we say, al menas lesaken, it's for a purpose of repair, correcting, fixing, for the purposes of an improvement. Now it leads us to the idea of rebuilding, renovation, as we would say nowadays. In the laws of Shabbos, Hilchot Shabbat, it says that anyone who destroys is exempt from liability, is not obligated to punishment for violating Shabbat, if the destruction is accomplished in a purposeless way. Wanton destruction, as we spoke about earlier. It's a Gemara in Shabbos. Nevertheless, one who tears his clothes in anger or out of an obligation, he has an obligation to mourn and tear a kriya, this person is liable because that destruction is for a purpose. It's toward an end. For in so doing, the person calms himself, puts his energies at rest, and since his anger is calmed through this breaking, tearing, shattering, whatever it is as if he is misaken, mitaken. He's doing it for a purposeful point. And therefore, such a person is liable for punishment for violating Shabbat. Since, as we already said, the Chorban, the destruction, was in a way of destroying such as to fulfill or placate or calm or exhaust God's anger, can't we say that the same parameters apply here, the idea of tikkun, of repair? To take the point even a little bit further, through fully venting his wrath, in order so as not to pour divine fury on Israel, on the Jewish people exclusively, as the Midrash Eicha noted, the destruction from our point of view, from the Jewish people's perspective, is a destruction in order to repair, because, quite simply, it's not possible to repair without some degree of taking apart. So this obviates the concept of Baal Tashchis. There isn't a wasteful, any kind of a wanton destruction. In this case, it's actually towards a goal. But up to this point, we haven't yet touched on the issue of the prohibition, do not do to God's mizbeach, to God's altar, as you have done with those altars, the altars of idolaters. Even though the prohibition of destroying the temple is specifically in a way of hashchata, destroying, as the Rambam writes, One of the Rambam's faithful commentaries, the Kesef Mishnah, remarks, if you break in order to repair, speaking about the Mizbeach, speaking about the temple structure, it's certainly permissible in order to repair, in order to rebuild the structure itself. In particular, as the Ramah, Reb Moses Isserli's comments in his glosses on Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim, even speaking about a synagogue, referring to a Beis Knesset, we're forbidden from taking a piece or a part from a synagogue unless it's in order to build another one. But if one takes for another purpose, even for another mitzvah, it's forbidden. The permissibility is only when the destruction is in order to build, and to build, as underscored by some of the other commentators, Taz, Prima Gadim, particularly in the same location. Perhaps we can say that this is what the Yalkut was emphasizing. If you think back to the beginning of our discussion, the Aryeh ascends and destroys in order that the Aryeh will come and build the Ariel. To emphasize that the point of destruction is Al-Manas, in order to reconstruct, to build, not only do we understand that there is no prohibition of destroying the temple, but the opposite may be the case. This very dismantling, the act of taking apart parts of the Beis HaMikdash, even on a large scale, is itself called building the Beis HaMikdash. I'm not just saying it. The Mordechai says it commenting on Maseches Megillah. Now we've started at least to come around to a point where we can see a possibility that the Churban and its results may actually be part of a building process. Perhaps this is why the Midrash uses the same imagery of the lion ascending in the mazal of the lion and destroying the lion, the Ariel, in order that the lion will come and rebuild the lion. Because it explains, even underscores, the inner meaning of the destruction, the fact that they're referred to with the same name. This gives us some powerful insight into Tisha B'Av, into the Churban, into the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, both the first and the second temple's destructions. God's construction of the third temple that this Midrash is talking about, the lion will come and build, this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Mazal of Aryeh, I will transform their mourning into gladness and rebuild the Ariel, as the prophet says, is not merely a process that is to begin at some point in the future, but rather it's a sequence of events that began with the destructions themselves. Even more, this is the tilos of the Churban. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God wanted to repair the shortcomings in the Beis HaMikdash so that they would not have the inherent deficiencies that the earlier ones had. What were those? By mere fact of being human constructs, they were by nature limited in their duration. Masha'ein Kain, whereas on the other hand, the divinely built third Beis HaMikdash, the third temple, would be one of an eternal quality, reflecting that quality in its creator. Therefore, the Churban of both Batei Mikdash are steps in the progression of completing and perfecting the edifice itself, in both the physical and the spiritual senses. When we view it as such, the destruction of the first two become part of the building process of the third. As a side note, there are at least two opinions in the concept of deconstructing in order to rebuild, hinging on whether the final project is of necessity, of better quality than the original. Masas Binyamin has one opinion. Leave that for another time. But with all this in mind that we've said up until now, we're also in a little bit better position to clarify another passage from Midrash Eicha Rabbah, the well-known story of a certain Arab who happened to be passing by a Jew in the field, and when he heard the lowing, the moo of the ox of this Jew, he told him, you know, you should know, your Beis HaMikdash, your temple has been destroyed. How do you know? Asked the Jew. Answered the Arab, I can tell it from the sound of your ox. At that very moment, the animal lowed again, and the Arab told the Jew, now I can tell that the Redeemer and Deliverer of the Jewish people is born. This Midrash might be suggesting to us a number of things to think about. One is the idea that the Messiah, the Redeemer and Deliverer of Israel, is born out of that very tragedy, contemporaneous with the nadir of Jewish history. So from the moment of destruction, the process is already in place to redeem us from our travails. Another similar idea that the Midrash Eicha wants us to think about is that along with the exile comes the preparation, the beginning, and even the possibility of the very redemption. The implication should be clear. After the Jews do tshuva, miyad hein negalin, according to, again, the Rambam, Hilchas Tshuva. And as the Zohar says, I am in exile, but my heart is awakened to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because of necessity, the Messiah is ready at the moment after the Churban. Therefore, it has the capability of being miyad. If the tshuva happens right away, right at the moment of destruction, the Redeemer has to be there. The solution already has to be present at the moment of the catastrophe. But more than this, Churban Bayis and the Gola and the building of the Third Temple are not disjointed in time. They don't suffer any kind of a chronological rupture without a moment between them. But actually, the instant one ends, based on this story, we can learn from this Midrash, the other begins. The very moment, at the moment of destruction, in the land of Israel itself, the Redeemer is born. Yisrael experiences the Churban in a tangible fashion. And as the halachas of Tisha B'Av remind us, that the point of this exercise in mourning that we're putting ourselves through is to awaken us to tshuva, that it may bring about rebuilding in the realist sense. The notion, the idea of the origin of the redemption being chronologically adjacent to the Churban first shows itself in the Churban Bayis Rishon, in the first temple's destruction. As in an earlier paradigm of Galus, the decree of exile, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God promises Avram Avinu, Abraham, that after his descendants will serve them and be oppressed by other nations, read at the beginning of Bereshis, they will go out berechush gadol, with great wealth. One view of this great wealth is that the descent, the whole servitude in Mitzrayim, was for the sake of ascent, namely that after it, we would go out with great wealth, not only the physical wealth, the material well-being, but also, and more importantly, the revelation of the Torah at Sinai, which, by the way, we're about to revisit this Shabbat in Moshe Rabbeinu's last great sermon, Chumash Devarim. Although we didn't know it at the time, we were prepared to trade this great wealth, the Rechush Gadol, whatever it would be, for an earlier freedom, says the Gemara in Brachas. Remember, by the way, that Shevet Levi, the tribe of Levi, was not enslaved. We might say that this is connected in some fashion to their keeping the value of Torah learning and mitzvah observance. So they felt a keener sense of the limitation, the restrictions in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, and they thus sought that much more to be transformed in a positive way by the experience of the Egyptian servitude, Shibud Mitzrayim. This is all an extremely optimistic reading, I admit, but what else can you do on Tisha B'Av? In that vein, since all sovereignties that have held temporal sway over us are referred to as Mitzrayim, because all the exiles we've experienced, in particular the present, hopefully the final one, the redemption seems to have begun long after the destruction. But in a deeper sense, since the intent is to provide us with the Rechush Gadol, the great wealth with which we'll ultimately leave the exilic condition, the redemption can be said to have begun at the very moment of exile's beginning. This is not only the heavenly perspective, God's take on things, as it were. Rather, this is the task, and it should be the perspective of a Jew in the world. When your cow moos, when your behema makes itself heard, you should realize what's going on. Even more, the mystical view maintains that the aspiration and the fulfillment of the Messianic era is to allow divine light to shine, to be reflected in this coarse physical world. All of this is dependent upon our efforts in exile, which contain the very seeds of redemption. And yet, with our two human eyes, we often fail to perceive this possibility. Tzaddikim, Jewish leaders with clarity of vision, can sense the geula, the redemption that's inherent and ready, min hamuchan, ready to go, out of Galut. We find that great figures and chachamim of Jewish history have tried to figure out when the end of time exactly will arrive, deriving their calculations from various prophecies and so on. However, the Gemara in Sanhedrin Perek Chelik calls malediction upon those who reckon the end of times. Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni, Amar Rabbi Yonason. One should not figure out the kitzin, the end of times. And the sages have wished ill to those who do so. At the same time, we see many such reckonings of the end of times in that very same chapter of Gemara, that same chapter of Talmud itself. We see it through the generations. Maimonides in Igeres Teman, the letter to Yemen, and even through to later generations. Various rabbis have sought to predict and to announce to us exactly when the end of times would arrive. Simply stated, the reason that calculating the end of time is discouraged is that people will not say, well, the predicted time, the Kates, came and it went, so it looks as though maybe it won't come after all. Rambam cautions us that this sort of defeatist thinking causes a weakness, a chalishus in the Jewish nation, though. It discourages faith, in particular faith in the imminence of redemption, in the Redeemer. That's why, Rambam explains, that's why the sages have prayed that their calculations cease and their excitement about this issue cool. However, from the fact that the sages of Israel have actually revealed certain reckonings of the Kates, of the end of time, it seems conversely that for a lofty purpose, Rambam actually mentions Sad Yigaon in this regard, in those times when the Jews were in a very low state of hope, a very weak state, the rabbis sought to give them hope and strengthen their faith via discussions, introducing into the conversation, in the Jewish conversation, the upcoming redemption. Perhaps we can conclude that since tzaddikim envision how our day-to-day efforts as individual Jews and as a nation during the exile hasten the redemption, they see the great advantages that accrue and the advantages we gain in galus, in exile, the rechush gadol, the great wealth. And our leaders seek to nurture us spiritually until the coming of the actual redemption. We should adopt their vision and recognize that the present exile, even this Tisha B'Av, has in it the potential for us to take rechush gadol, not just material well-being, but spiritual growth and development as well. This is not something that we have to wait for, something that will occur at some distant point in the future. It's actually in potential all around us and awaits only our resolution to make every moment, every day count in a positive way. As we are in exile with the Shechina itself, may we be comforted, and may God's presence itself that is with us in exile be comforted. And may we see, with no lacuna of time at all, the comfort that we've been waiting and working for, anticipating, a rebuilt temple, a restored Beis HaMikdash, a complete Jewish people keeping a complete Torah in a complete land of Israel, and good health and in happiness. May we see it now. Thank you.